Welcome everybody to Photography Insights, the show that goes behind the scenes and interviews people from the photography world. Welcome to this week's podcast with me, your host, The Flogger. As I explore this medium of photography and play around, I become interested in many areas. One of these that always springs to mind is that of double exposure. I remember when running my competitions with Kodak Alaris, that was quite a few multiple exposure entries, and in fact one of them by Ben Felton won a honourable mention and obviously stuck in my conscious mind somehow. So I thought, hell, I had not interviewed someone who does this sort of work consistently, so let's get him on the show. Ben was very willing and I really couldn't wait to talk to him. Now bear in mind, Ben is from France, but has lived in a few countries and is currently living in Hong Kong. So if you're expecting a heavy French accent, you might be surprised. Anyway, Ben's a family man like myself and a very decent guy. And after speaking with Ben, I've come up with this idea of an act of random kindness every day. The idea is to search for someone on Instagram and share their picture on your story. Nice and simple. It would be great to hear of you doing this too. Just remember, karma everyone. Do something nice for someone and feel positive. Something I started on Monday the 12th of October. It's gone well so far. 2 days in, someone's liked and reacted to what I've done for them. And I'm going to try and do this on Facebook. And I might even try and do it on Twitter. So that's three different people, three different sorts of pictures at any one time. So Ben, thank you. Fantastic idea, my friend. Now this podcast is all about Ben's pursuit of happiness with multiple exposure and his Human Nature project. It's a learning journey and he talks to us about both the technical and conceptual aspects too. So it's very useful. So in this one, we're going to discuss multiple exposures, the how-tos, multiple exposures, some of the issues. It's going to talk about background choices, shooting X-Pan, and the studio versus a home session, negative space versus busy backgrounds, cyanotypes, photograms, Hong Kong restrictions, and zines. Please do keep the reviews coming in. They're very much appreciated. And please do keep sharing with your friends. The numbers are slowly increasing again, so it's really nice to have people back on board while we all go through this COVID nightmare together. You'll notice that's given me a little bit of time at home, so I've managed to write a couple of articles. And also remember, I've put on there about my last project I did. That was my collaborative one. So I do hope you enjoy that work. And please do remember the friends of the show. So we've got Steve at Chroma with his large format cameras. We've got Pete at Static Age with his array of zines. And obviously David at FilmDef for all your lab needs. So I suppose there's nothing else to do, play the music, and await our lovely guest, Benoit Felton. And welcome to the show, Benoit.
Hello. Great to see you.
It is. It's nice to meet you finally. It's actually been a while in a way, because I think we first hooked up through Instagram through one of my competitions.
Indeed. That was when I submitted one of my double exposures and it won an honorable mention. Yeah, indeed. That was great.
Yeah, it was so nice, I got to admit, to get involved with so many people because there were so many talented people. And when you see work like yours, it's so different to someone who can maybe just take a really nice photo in my eyes.
Yeah, and I mean, it was interesting because, you know, as I was looking at the winners, I was thinking, yeah, these are nice photos, but they're not out of the ordinary. And I guess I'm coming from such a different direction with that particular series that it makes you shift the way you look at things. And I think it's made me realize that I suppose that being or doing something different is something that I value more than I thought I did. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't stop me from doing a lot of more kind of mainstream, if that's the right word, you know, type of photography. But I suppose, yeah, I value originality a bit more than I used to.
Yeah, it's funny how things change in that sense, because I'm more veering towards your side, where it's more about art and being different than maybe being mainstream and creating something everybody likes.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, I've never had as much interest on Instagram as with this series. So even when you think that you're being edgy, maybe that's the moment where actually people stop paying attention. In part because, and I think for this particular project, it's the kind of images that few people have ever seen. And so as a consequence, it does, you know, raise your attention. And then, you know, then my eldest son says, I don't understand what you're doing. I can't relate to this stuff. So, you know, it keeps me grounded.
Yeah, family is so nice, aren't they?
Well, at least it's, you know, I'd rather he said that than pretend he likes it if he doesn't. So, yeah, I'm fine with that.
Yeah, I'm the same, yeah. My family, but I don't know what that is, Daddy, and what's I don't understand what that is, and that's not very good. And you're like, thank you for your honesty.
Exactly.
All part of being a father. It's all the fun of it. I think, like, the competition side, I think it's helped me in the sense when we was doing it, we was picking out our favourites, both me and it might have been Andy at that time at Kodak Alaris. And obviously, he's very experienced in the field, so he was looking for something. I was just looking for nice things. But now, I think I'd be the other way, where I'll be looking at photos like yourself, and I'm now seeing the art, the effort, and shooting for a purpose.
Well, I mean, you've been doing a fair bit of kind of studio / portrait work and some pretty out there stuff yourself. And so I think the more you explore that as a photographer, the more you relate to it when you see it in others. And I mean, you know, again, there's nothing wrong with, you know, a well-executed photo of something that, you know, maybe we've all seen already one way or another. It's just that I find for my own creative process, it doesn't quite feed me in the same way. I mean, I still do a lot of street photography here in Hong Kong, because there's so many, you know, cool moments and cool things where you think, oh, this is going to be a really nice photo. But I honestly don't get quite the same kick out of it, because I know that I've already seen, when I see my pictures, I know I've already seen them, if you see what I mean. I mean, someone else has already done that picture in one configuration or another. I think, you know, street, interestingly, gives you the illusion that what you're doing is unique, because intellectually, you know that that particular moment with those particular people, etc., that is a unique moment, and therefore no one can have exactly photographed that the way you did. But then when you think of it in terms of, you know, what's unique artistically about that photo, quite often the answer is not a lot. And, you know, I have a great admiration for documentary photography, which is a little bit different, because then the purpose isn't artistic. It's that doesn't mean they can't be artistic, but the purpose is to depict, you know, a place, a certain theme, etc. But I'm not probably not kind of single minded and dedicated enough to work on that as a, you know, kind of as a documentary pursuit. So really what's left is, yeah, I've got some nice pics, and some are nicer than others, and some really speak to me, and some I suppose represents aspects of Hong Kong that I find really interesting and exciting. But objectively, none of these pictures are, you know, wow, because they're,
it's real. It's
street photographs, and then you want to keep it exactly. You want to keep it kind of grounded and down to earth, because otherwise you're moving into another field. So yeah, and I suppose, you know, part of it is the practicality. It's here when the weather is nice, I'll virtually never move around without a camera in my hand, and I'm someone who loves to walk around, so I walk. I've deliberately, because I work as an independent like you do, but I found that working from home is challenging in terms of the, you know, kind of structuring of your work environment, and so I subscribe, rent, whatever the word is. I'm in a shared office space, and I deliberately picked one that was a few kilometers away from where I live, just so that I would have to walk, every day there. And that's a good way of getting some excitement out of your photography as well, because when you do the same route every day, you start noticing the patterns and how things change seasonally. You start, you know, recognizing people who are at the same place at the same time every day. And when you suddenly do it at a different time of the day, for whatever reason, you realize that actually there's a lot of different things that you haven't photographed because it's a different time of day, or the light is different, et cetera. So you start noticing little things which are really interesting as well. So I love doing that. There's no doubt about it. But I suppose right now this double exposure project, which I've called Human Natures, is really the thing that gives me the most kick in my work, for sure.
It's funny, because I think what you're saying is probably something that happens to a lot of us. Is I think initially when you get into photography, you're chasing light, you may be fluking circumstances, and you're using what you've got at the time. But when you walk a lot and go the same paths, you'll actually know where light is going to be. So you can use that to your advantage, can't you?
Yeah. And also, there's a familiarity with the area that also gives you an edge in terms of, I actually have a great example of just what you're saying. And unfortunately this year, the weather was really crap in that same period. But last year, mid to end of September, as I was walking home one late afternoon, I realized there was this one street where you got a direct sunset in the alignment of the street. And it's my guess is it happens only for about 3 weeks in the year. And so I noticed where it was. So the next day I came back with the camera and I took a bunch of shots of people walking into, like, with the light in their back. So those really long shadows.
Oh, yeah,
so
yeah.
Gorgeous, right?
Yeah.
I quite liked the photos, but they weren't, I didn't spend enough time framing and figuring out where the absolute best spot was, etc. And so this year I actually had it on my agenda. I checked the note, because these were digital pictures, so I actually had the date where they were taken. So I thought, okay, 13th of September, that's around the right time. And then those 3 weeks were the weather was absolutely shitty, and there was just no sunset to be seen. So if I'm still around next year, I know where I'm going to be in mid-September.
That's always the same, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but it's part of it as well, as you can never anticipate. So, you know, one of the things that still is on my list that I haven't ticked is some good shots of Hong Kong in the rain. So when it rains here, it can be absolutely unbelievably brutal.
Yeah.
And I think that's some massive opportunities for really, like, shots unlike any other, for two reasons. A, no one in their right minds goes out when it's raining, especially when it's raining like crazy. And B, because of how harsh the rain is, it actually, gives you those shots of people running like crazy with just a briefcase on their heads and, this kind of stuff, which is, you know, it's not something that you see on a daily basis. No. But the thing is, it's really harsh, but it's really quick as well. So usually if I'm at home and it starts raining like that, by the time I get out, it's over. Oh. So there's a huge element of luck in just being there at the right place at the right time. Actually, a few weeks ago, I was at there's a great photo gallery here in Hong Kong called Blue Lotus. And they did an artist session where everybody presents their projects and we discuss it, and et cetera. And just as we were talking, it was around 8 PM, this deafening sound of rain came out. And this is on the heights of Central, quite high. So you can only access it through stairs. There's no street that actually stops in front of this place. Wow. And actually the water was cascading down the stairs and it was literally a waterfall. And I didn't have a camera with me and I was so pissed off because honestly, I mean, okay, the chances of me having a tripod would have been fairly limited, but honestly, camera, tripod and umbrella, and I would have had a absolutely fantastic shot. But you know, c'est la vie. There's mm-hmm. opportunities you can grasp and the ones you can't. And I suppose, you know, going back to the portrait side of things is one of the reasons you do that as well is that then you're in charge of organizing it. You're not dependent on opportunities so much. You get the more creative control in terms of doing what you want. Mm. And that's something I found very interesting as well, because I hadn't really spent any significant time in the studio before I started this project. I'd done a few sessions here and there, but you know, I had some lights at home and, you know, sometimes when friends came over, I improvised a little session or for my daughter's birthday to take photos of her friends and stuff like that. But, nothing as systematic as I've done here with this project.
Okay. So it's very different for you. I mean, obviously I'm really, really interested in some of this recent work you've been doing, this multiple exposure. So talk us through what multiple exposure is, because a lot of people, whether digital or analog, it's something way out there. How do we do it? What you've learned from it and how to make it easier?
Right. Okay. And I have to stress that there's some technical challenges that I have overcome, but are not, because they're really dependent on specific gear that's quite pricey. So just because I explained it doesn't necessarily mean everybody would be able to do it as easily. Okay. So, I mean, quite simply, when you shoot when you do an exposure on film negative, basically, let's talk black and white just to simplify things for now, sure. Right? Basically, you get light areas on the negative and dark areas on the negative, mm-hmm. right? The dark areas are, which are going to turn out to be the highlights of the positive. So the dark areas are basically where the emulsion has reacted to light.
Yeah.
Right? The light areas are where the emulsion has reacted very little or not at all. Mm-hmm. Okay? Which means that there's still emulsion on the negative after you've shot. So mm-hmm. if you shoot again on the same exposure, that emulsion is going to react. Mm. And you're going to get a second exposure that's going to superimpose, particularly in the light areas of the negative, and therefore the dark areas of the photo, right? Mm. So I was going to say early years of photography, but that's probably all the way into the 90s. A lot of cameras actually had a double exposure option. And before that, because everything was manual, it was very simple. You did a double exposure by not advancing your film after you've done your first shot. And sometimes, in fact, probably most of the double exposures in photographic history were accidental because people forgot to wind the film and then took the next frame over the first frame. So that's a process that's always fascinated me. But the way these double exposure functions, if we can call it that, work in most film cameras, is that basically you're going to take one shot and then you're going to superimpose the shot immediately after that one. Right? Because mechanically that's how it works. And that inherently limits what you can do with it. Because, you know, typically, you know, if you're in a studio, you're going to take one shot and then the second shot is also going to be in the studio. But if you're in the middle of a forest, your first shot, unless you take that shot and then you wait 3 days to go back and go in the studio, is going to be of the forest as well.
Yeah.
So I have a friend, Jules Lemoyle, who is French, really, really good French film photographer. He does a lot of this political stuff as well. Okay. And he used to do quite a bit of film swapping where basically one photographer would shoot an entire roll of something and then send it to another photographer who would shoot the entire roll again. And then they'd look at how the double exposures came out. And that's kind of a fun, very chaotic process because you don't even know if the photos are going to be aligned the same. Subjects were obviously likely to be very different. But the main challenge actually is simply frame alignment. So if you do it like that, right, there's no way to guarantee that the second shooter is going to have the frames aligned with the first shooter. So actually most of your shots are wasted because the frame dividers are just in the middle of the exposures. And so that's a process that really didn't satisfy me all that much. And the other thing is that I've always aspired to use this technique in a kind of more structured way, I suppose. But talking to Jules made me realize that there might be some potential there. I just didn't quite know how to figure it out. And then I realized something, which was the kind of the technical spark for the project. I'll talk about the conceptual spark after, if that's okay. But the technical spark was this. So when I was living in Shanghai, the early days of being there, I saw this video on YouTube that presented the Hasselblad X-Pan camera. The Hasselblad X-Pan is a camera that shoots two frames in width on a 135 roll. So you get these really wide panoramic shots. And I thought, this is so cool. I need to get this. I had no idea at the time how expensive it was. And I had no idea how expensive it would become. But in Shanghai, there is a huge photo mall, which is like five stories of only photo shops. And all of these have different, you know, specialities. And one of them was specialized in selling secondhand film cameras. And I found an X-Pan there. At the time, I think I've calculated this recently. At the time, I think it was a quarter of the price it is now. It was still a pretty pricey camera, but you know, I talked to my wife and I made it one of my combined Christmas and birthday presents. And so I bought this camera, and for a number of years, I did a lot of panoramic shots, which we might come back to because that's the focus of one of my zines. But then I realized something when I was thinking about these double exposures, and that is that the Hasselblad, in order to, actually, there's two things, right? The first thing is that the X-Pan lets you shoot panoramic, but also normal frames. So they wanted to give you the option of doing both. But then, in order for you to know how many frames you've got left on the roll, they had to implement a system whereby instead of shooting from the start of the roll, when you put your roll of film inside the camera, it winds the entire roll of film in.
Oh.
Then it can actually calculate how much length you've got left and tell you, oh, if you're shooting panoramic, you've got 3 shots left. And if you're shooting normal, you've got 7 shots left, for example.
Right. Didn't know that.
But because of this, I realized that this might be the perfect camera to actually align the frames in a double exposure, because the starting point of the film is going to be exactly the same each time.
Mm-hmm.
So about 3 years ago, I did a test roll with my kids, which came out horrible in terms of exposure and stuff. And none of these photos have been published anywhere, but it just proved the point that the frames were aligned, which okay. was really what I wanted to test first and foremost. So that was the technical starting point. And then I thought, okay, I know I can do this now. So I know I can go and shoot an entire roll of something and then shoot an entire roll of portraits. And the something is going to be superimposed on the portraits.
Mm-hmm.
So then the question was, what is that something going to be?
Yeah.
And I think at around the same time, I started becoming, I suppose I'd been aware of, environmental issues and stuff like that for a long time, but it started becoming quite top of my mind in many ways. And at the same time, it made me realize that, I work in technology like you, and there is a particular rabbit hole in technology where you kind of start thinking that technology is going to solve everything. and there's a lot of people that I see on a daily basis who have this really kind of techno optimism where basically, climate change, hey, not to worry, we're going to figure out some way of sucking the CO2 out of the atmosphere and stuff like that. And I guess I started being really disturbed by this viewpoint, which is kind of an excuse for not making any effort, individually and collectively, just thinking that that it's going to get solved by technology. And so it made me realize that we've moved further and further away from nature. And I wanted to try and express this idea in a project that that we are one with nature. We're not, humans are not separate from nature. They are part of nature. And so that then made it obvious what I needed to superimpose was like these floral textures or vegetal textures that were evocative of nature, and superimpose that on people. So you get the human and the natural world blended together, which is why I ultimately called the project Human Natures. And so I had the technique. I kind of knew how to get the technique because there was a big learning curve in actually executing. And I had the idea. And so summer 2 years ago, I was back in France. I was meeting with some friends. We had a long weekend with, a bunch of friends. So before I left Hong Kong, I shot 2 rolls of textures. I just went around. The forest is plenty of jungle and forest here. And there's a great botanical garden as well, probably more than one. So I just went around, shot 2 rolls of textures. And then I asked them, who wants to try this? And usually when we do these kind of meetups, I'm the guy who does the photos. So they all said, well, not all, but like 5 or 6 of them said, okay. I said, you have to be, bare chested. Because I had this concept from the start that, in order for it to work conceptually, you needed to have like skin on texture on skin, not texture on silhouettes with clothes and everything.
Yeah.
So these 4 or 5 guys agreed, and I shot these 2 rolls, and I probably have, I think in the final kind of tally of the project as it currently stands, I probably have 4 or 5 shots from these 2 rolls that I've kept. And they highlighted some of the issues that I then addressed, but they also proved that it had legs and it worked. Mm. And when I started showing the pictures, I started getting really great response. I think in part because people didn't know or hadn't really seen this before. And in part because hopefully it speaks to people, this idea that, you know, that this blend actually has an evocative power that it goes hopefully a little bit beyond just pretty pics, if you see what I mean. And so that was the start of the project. Since then, I've done 3 full studio sessions and 1 here at home during lockdown with my kids, because you get the models you can. and it's been a really interesting process. Yeah, it's really been interesting because you quickly realize that lighting in the studio takes an even more crucial importance because all of the dark areas in the picture are going to show texture. All of the light areas are going to show either very little or none at all.
Yeah.
And so how you light actually determines not only how good your portrait is, which would be the case with any studio shoot, but also where the texture is going to show up. And so it's been really interesting, and I'm not there yet in terms of, you know, being able to say I master this now. I'm very far from that. And there's still a lot of accidentals, a lot of crap pictures, and some happy accidents as well. So things that I've realized actually because I made some mistakes, and some of the stuff that came out looked really cool. And I was like, how the hell can this look like this? And then I realized, oh, okay, I was underexposing, or I was overexposing, or whatever, you know, or that light was there, not where I thought it was, or whatever, you know, lots of different aspects. So at first, just to finish on the kind of conceptual technical part, at first I shot everything on a brightly lit white background. With the idea that that would eliminate the texture.
Yes,
because these areas then on the negative, that burns the emulsion, not burns, but, you know, it kind of precipitates the emulsion completely. So you get full white or very, very faint texture, but virtually nothing. So it creates separation, which is really interesting. I was talking to a guy here in Hong Kong who saw the pictures, and he gave me a really interesting piece of advice. He said, I really like this, but I'm not sure people here would like it. And I was like, why? And he says, well, there's so much visual clutter in Hong Kong that people tend to not like negative space. When there's lots of emptiness in the frame, that they tend to not relate to it. And he said, you know, you should find a way to actually have very busy backgrounds instead of, you know, clear white backgrounds. And so I mulled around on this, and I realized that if I just inverted the approach and if I used a black background, then I would have texture everywhere except where the subject is lit. So that led to a second portion of the work where you effectively have the subject blended differently, right? Rather than being blended with the texture on their skin, they emerge from the texture with less and less texture on their skin where the areas are mostly lit. And that gave some really interesting results. That's just from the last studio session. So I haven't really explored that as much as I have the white background, you know, stuff, but it's interesting. And that's definitely on the to-do list of more work to be done.
I mean, I think it's lovely. I'm looking back at some of the stuff from this project, and it's great. I mean, it just shows that the practice side really helped. It's beautiful, and I think the fact that black and white, because I don't even think black and white is that easy to do correctly anyway, to be honest, especially with double exposure.
So actually, because you got involved with this through one of the color pictures, this is also maybe an interesting point to make, is that in the initial, actually in the first, not the very first one, but the first 3 proper studio sessions I did with actual studio lights and everything, the very first session was shot in sunlight. I did both black and white and color. And color, I suppose I would say, I got less hits with color. I got less pitches I was satisfied with, but a few of them were really cool. But I realized that in a way it emphasizes something very different. The textures become kind of secondary, and it's the colors that become really primary when you do color, which is kind of obvious. And I think that probably deserves a whole exploration on its own.
Yeah.
And I realized I couldn't do both at the same time. So I think from now on, I'm focusing on the black and white, which doesn't mean that I'm giving up the color, but I'm kind of pushing that back to further, like, down the road when I'll be a bit more stable on the black and white side of things, more satisfied with what I get, getting higher hit rates in terms of, you know, how many good shots do I get out of a session. And then maybe I'll revisit color. But yeah, so the emphasis now is on black and white. And of course, the other reason why that makes sense is that I've started doing cyanotypes, which is a development process, sorry, a printing process that you know, only works with black and white photos. So, so obviously combining those two elements kind of focuses me on the black and white for the time being.
Obviously cyanotypes is something I'm really interested in doing at some point. Probably too late for summer this year. But yeah, it was on my list. I did a lot of, Lumen prints this year instead. So I stuck with that. But again, it's nice because, like, you can think, well, next year I've got something really nice to look forward to. I can maybe plan towards it, which is always a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's two things that are really, I think, important to remember with cyanotypes. The first one is that it's really easy to do. I mean, you won't necessarily get good results from day one, but it is actually really easy to do. It requires very minimal setup. You know, it's not like darkroom printing where suddenly you have to think about equipment, and even if it's not expensive, but it is, but it's not super expensive, but it's like the space and the chemicals and all of that. It's a pretty involved process. Cyanotype is something you can do with your kids on a Sunday afternoon, and you know, they'll get a kick out of it and you'll get a kick out of it, maybe a different kick. But and I actually did that this summer. I actually bought some So, I mean, long story short, I did a bit of cyanotypes over 10 years ago. This photographer friend of mine in Ireland, Sinead, she basically showed me how cyanotypes worked, how you can do it. And I loved it. And I thought, I did two pictures back then. And I thought, I got to do this again. And I never did for whatever reason. And so this summer, or just before the summer, I thought, okay, we're stuck here. We're not going back to Europe. I'm going to do some cyanotypes. And then I realized that it was very complicated to buy the chemicals here. Well, actually, I couldn't find them. Let's put it that way, right?
Yeah.
And right now, because of the security whole thing here in Hong Kong, you're not allowed to import chemicals.
Right. Okay.
As an individual. Yeah. No matter what it is. I mean, obviously there's nothing that goes into, you know, explosive manufacturing and cyanotype chemicals, but they don't care. It's just bottles of stuff. They don't know what it is. And
yeah.
So my first step, which is what I really recommend people do, because it's a very cheap way of getting into it, is I ordered some pre-coated cyanotype paper. And that way you don't have to bother with the chemical side of it, and you can just give it a try. And you can do photograms. So, you know, with kids, they put shapes, leaves, whatever on the cyanotype. You expose it. It's really pretty. It's kind of a magical process when they see it emerge. And, you know, it's very, very easy to do. And as long as you've got a printer that can print, you know, acetate transparents, you can do photographs as well. Now, again, they're maybe not going to be awesome as photograph cyanotypes go, but it's a good starting point. And then you can also decide if you like it enough to actually explore the process more in depth, which is kind of where I'm at now. I finally found some sources of chemicals, and then it become immediately a lot more involved because sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. So you have to figure out what went wrong. What's the difference between what I did half an hour ago and what I did just now that actually gave me this completely different look on the final image? Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's quite a lot of things I have to iron out in the process. But interestingly, in my initial run, I went to a local printers and I did 10 digital negatives. So just to explain to people, historically, cyanotypes were either photograms, so objects imprinted on the paper, or positive prints, which were done with digital negatives, which were either 4x5 or 8x10. So because we produced really big negatives in the early days of photography, you could just put your negative on the paper, expose it to the sun, and you would have a photo. Of course, now our negatives are really tiny. So if I was to take that and do it, it might look interesting, but it's not what I was after. Hmm. So the easiest way to do it is you actually take the scan of your photo, you invert it so you get a negative, and you print that on transparent paper, the stuff that we used, 15 right. years ago for overhead presentations, and you have your digital negative. And that's what you put on top of your cyanotype to expose to the sun.
Right.
It's actually a fairly simple process once you understand how it works. Mm. Of course, that's a rabbit hole in and of itself, because depending on how well your negative is printed, then you're going to have different results on the positive, etc. But at least in terms of first steps, it's quite easy. And when I first got those first 10 digital negatives that I got printed by a local printer, I just took a variety of photos that I had just to see what the different types of photos might yield in terms of results. And then I was showing this to a friend of mine the owner of the Blue Lotus Gallery. And she saw one of the ones of my son where there's all this texture in his beard. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, this is just the link to Anna Atkins. And I don't know if you know the story, but the first photographic book that exists is a book of cyanotypes. And they were actually photograms. This was published in the early or late 1840s. And this was a botanist, Anna Atkins, and she was, or maybe Ann Atkins, I should check, but, and she was fascinated with algae. And so she did these photograms of dried algae where you see the texture, the veins, everything through, basically by the sunlight, imprinting it through the leaf or whatever it is that she put on the photo. And so there's a kind of a thematic link here that's really interesting, which is that, cyanotype was first used for plants, and I'm doing this thing that involves plant textures. So it really makes sense in the sense of a kind of continuity in the history of photography to kind of loop back to this very first book of photographs. Hmm. And so that's when I started to focus on this project alone for cyanotypes. I'll come back to the rest of my stuff later. Mm. But right now I wanted to get the process really as consistent as I could. And there's still a long way to go, but I've really, with the help of some online comments here and there, I've actually figured out one of the issues that I had in my early trials, which was that the cyanotypes, instead of coming blue on white, which is the normal look of a cyanotype, they would come in blue on yellow. And some of these images look really great. That's not the issue.
Yeah.
But I couldn't understand why. And part of the process is replicability. You want to know why this comes out looking the way it does.
Yeah.
And I finally figured out that the normal way that you do this is that you coat your paper with cyanotype solution, you wait for it to dry maybe 10, 15 minutes, and then you expose it, right? Okay. But what I was doing was I was coating my paper, like I was doing a batch of 10 on a Sunday evening, And then over the week when sunlight came out, I just took a sheet out and exposed it. Mm. And actually, the chemical, I think partly due to the humidity here, it actually oxidizes or whatever. It's probably the wrong word, but, you know, it reacts.
Yeah.
And so instead of washing away, it would stay, or it would tint.
Like staying.
It would turn to this kind of verdigris color, which okay. I thought was really cool, but I wanted to be able to do it without it. And so that was a big moment, because now I know that if I want that look, I just prepare my paper 5 days in advance and I will get that look more or less controlled. And if I want a more kind of monochromatic white and blue, I just do it with fresh cyanotype immediately. So that was a big kind of, you know, stride forward in the project. So I've selected a little over 50 exposures from the Human Natures Project. Mm-hmm. And I'm slowly, gradually making my way through all of them so that I can actually look at all of them side by side and say, okay, this one works, this one clearly doesn't. Because there's a lot of different looks in the picture.
There is, yeah.
And some of them I already know it's not carrying through to cyanotype. So even if I like the image, it just doesn't work as a cyanotype. And so the idea is to do that. And that will let me basically take stock of what I've got and what it really looks the best. It, obviously, in the meantime, I'm refining the process. So, you know, I've now got my exposure times pretty much figured out for the chemicals that I have, because I have two sets of chemicals and I've noticed that they don't have the same exposure times. So, you know, there's a lot of things that you just have to trial and error in order to figure out where you're going. The next step is the negative. So one of the issues that a lot of people have, and it's definitely an issue that I'm having, is that when you laser print the negatives, the blacks tend to be not black enough, so they don't shut out the light completely. So instead of having blue on white, you have dark blue on light blue.
Right.
Or rather, I should say, instead of having dark blue on white, you have dark blue on light blue. Mm. Again, in some pictures, that's a great look. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I want that extra bit of contrast, and right now I can't get it. So there's a workaround, but I found that workaround to be nearly as bad as the initial thing, which is that you print two identical negatives and you superimpose them. But the problem is that if one of them moves ever so slightly, you get a blurred shot. So I've tried that, and some of the pics came out okay, but I'm kind of pulling away from that now, because I wasted so many of them just because there's an area that was not superimposed perfectly and I didn't see it. So the real fix is to get an inkjet printer, and I've identified the printer that I need. I budgeted for it, and unfortunately, because of COVID, the old model is no longer sold and the new model has not arrived on the market yet. So I'm just waiting for that to be available. That should be another big stride forward. And then the last and kind of probably most challenging bit is that I want to try and do larger prints. So right now I'm just doing A4 prints.
Okay.
But I want to try and do A3 and maybe even A2 prints. Yeah. And that's a whole different kettle of fish, in particular because you have to find the acetate paper that's big enough.
Yeah.
To do the digital negatives. You know, there's probably some challenges I'm not even thinking of in terms of how you wash it, in terms of all of that. Yeah. But that's kind of where I'm at in terms of this. And I suppose to finish on that, on this project, maybe, although I'm sure you'll have some questions, but the overall goal is I would like to get some galleries interested in showing this stuff. And I think because it's different and somewhat unique, if I can get their attention, hopefully I can get them to look into it a little deeper. Obviously, again, these times right now, about the worst time to just, you know, I thought, okay, next summer I'm going back to Paris. I'm printing 10 or 12 pictures from the set, maybe a couple of cyanotypes, and are taking that with me. And I'm going to just walk around Paris. And every time I see a photo gallery, I'm just going to walk in and show it to them and see if they're interested. But obviously none of that is possible right now. So, you know, I'm kind of doubling down on getting better and better stuff rather than exposing it because I can't.
It's not a bad thing. Yeah. Well, practice is everything, isn't it? Because you want the consistency to get the results, don't you?
Yeah. Especially if you're going to sell prints, cyanotype prints, because no two cyanotypes look the same. There's no such thing as a perfectly replicable cyanotype. I mean, that's true of analog printing to a certain extent, but
yeah,
actually seeing the difference between two analog prints that have been done identically, you really have to have an expert eye. With cyanotypes, just because I expose the same amount of time, the coating might be different. Obviously, if the paper is different, the look is going to be entirely different. So all of these things affect the look of the final print. And so part of the challenge, but also part of the fun, I think, is to tell people, you know, you like this picture, you have to understand that if you purchase this, it is not going to look exactly like this.
Yeah.
And that's part of what you embrace, is that you're going to have a unique piece in your home.
Yeah.
That, you know, even if 20 people buy the same print you bought, they're all going to be different. Mm. And that's something I find quite interesting. And I've decided that, you know, that you should embrace that rather than fear that.
Yeah, you should. Yeah, because it's more art than photography in that sense, isn't it? Because, you know, a digital photograph, you believe you can digitally print it the same, you get consistency, you can sell it. But if you asked an artist to paint the same thing twice, I would think that would be pretty hard to do.
Yeah, and he would probably tell you to, you know, sod off. But
yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, you spent your life doing one piece. It's like you must want to just move on to the next anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, so that's kind of where I'm at with this project. And it is, you know, kind of 80% of my photography time right now.
I mean, it's lovely. I mean, I'm looking at some of the photos now, and I think this sort of thing is exactly what you're saying, is some work better than others. You can see there's some strong blues coming through. But there's a lady who's looking towards the top right of a frame. It looks like she's naked. And you've got they look like bubbles. And then she's got some leaves towards the right-hand side.
Yeah. So that was one of the early dark background ones. Mm-hmm. Right, so the texture is everywhere rather than being delineated on the silhouette.
Yeah,
and these were just kind of small. There's a small flower bed somewhere, but there were some kind of ferns in the middle.
Yeah,
and I thought, oh, that's really interesting, because you have these two things that, you know, one of them is pretty systematic in a way. It's a kind of structured texture, but the other one kind of breaks that. The regularity, the ferns just break the regularity. On this session, I had some really, I mean, on all the sessions, the models were amazing, but this girl, Victoire, she was very kind of, she had this lovely smile. She's very positive looking. I don't know how to describe it exactly, but when that picture came through, it just made me feel like a kind of, you know, a fairy tale queen or something like that. Something really evocative. And I think the cyanotype makes it look even better.
Mm. Yeah, and you can definitely see the differences, like you're saying, where it's only highlighted around the body sort of thing. I mean, this one's lovely as well. Model was Lara. So that looks like leaves just along the back of her. From the top of her head all the way down to, like, probably just above the bum area.
Right. And what I like about that one, I think it's very symptomatic of one of the things that I've mentioned before, is that Lara has dark hair. And so the texture is going to come out a lot more there than it is in the rest of the body. And so one of the things that I hope I'll be able to do going forward is also to shoot models with, you know, very different complexions, very different skin tones, very different hair color, because the result is just radically different. And so, you know, as I was mentioning earlier, during lockdown, I asked my kids if they would agree to do one session with me. And I got a few really good shots out of this, including, so my son has grown a beard during lockdown and he's got dark hair. So there's one shot of, you know, his beard having all the leaf texture coming through, but his face has very little. So the contrast is really pronounced there. But my daughter has blonde hair. And so the shot I took of her, the texture is actually quite even across the entire body and hair. And it's a completely different look. And it's really interesting when you think about it, because the lighting was the same, the technique was the same, the texture was the same, the exposure was the same, but the look is completely different. And that's what I really like about this project, is that I surprise myself, or it surprises me, all the time when I look at the results and I go, oh, wow, I never imagined this was going to come out looking like this. And so part of the fun is, you know, learning to replicate the looks that you really like. And then part of the fun is also embracing this unexpected aspect of it. So I've consciously resisted going full systematic on what I'm doing, you know, kind of writing down each frame, what's the texture, where is it? Because I could, I suppose, go down that route and say, okay, I've got a branch here, so let's put an arm here just to, so that they superimpose. And it might be really interesting, but I think that's not me. It's a bit too kind of controlled, if you see what I mean. So I want to try to find a balance between the, I know what I'm doing, but also I'm letting the possibility open that I'm going to be surprised by something. And so actually I'm doing I finally found some models here in Hong Kong, because all of my other models were in Europe. So I'm doing a session next week and I've decided to shoot one roll of just random textures and not write anything down. So the other rolls I'm kind of more, you know, okay, this is ferns, this is whatever, barks, or, you know, I've tried various, various things, but I've tried to keep them consistent on a single roll. They're going to be all more or less the same, but I think I will shoot one roll of just whatever and just embrace as a kind of end of session thing. Okay, let's go through that roll. No idea what it's going to look like. But hopefully there'll be some happy accidents in there that I'm really happy. I did.
I think that's nice. Cause I think, you know, you're taking a dedicated methodical approach to the work, but the artistic side is you're letting a little bit of nature and a little bit of whatever happen. I think that's really lovely.
Yeah, that's the idea. we'll see how it pans out, but that's the idea anyway. Yeah,
I'm sure it'll be lovely. I mean, you've got some cracking shots there, and it's really nice to talk about something that's so different. It's just different sides, isn't it? That's all it is. I did what you said with multiple exposure early on with the model, and I blew it all out. So I went below her and I shot into the sun. So everything around her was white. But the reason I did it was she had black hair. And then what I did was take a picture of the grass next to her. And then the grass just filled all her hair.
Yeah.
So it looked like her hair was grass, and the shot worked really well. And she was like, wow, that's amazing. I'm like, yeah, that's no editing. That's purely just, you know, messing about it. I think you learn about light as well.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Absolutely.
I think it really helps, because really what you're doing is painting in.
But except you're not. That's the point. A painting is a kind of conscious decision to. Parts, right? So, what you did was you basically used natural light and then the contrast on the model, which is some of my pictures use that. But sometimes I'll decide the light is here on the right and the back is going to be effectively backlit, so the texture is going to be really strong. And sometimes I'll decide the light's on the top facing the face, so the face will have no texture whatsoever. And then the more you go down the body, the more texture there is. There's one of the shots in the I haven't done a cyanotype of it yet, but it was one of the shots I really liked in the initial session, which is it's a full frontal nude of a guy, and you can't see anything because his face is normal, but gradually as it goes down, his body has more and more texture. And so it looks like he's clad in leaves. And I was just, I love that. And that was completely at the time accidental. I didn't consciously think, okay, you know, the light is going to be like this, etc. The first session was an exhilarating nightmare. Because, very quickly, when I published these very first shots, a friend of mine contacted me and she said, I would love to pose for this. I'd love the look of these pictures. And so the next time I was in her area, I set it up, but I realized it was going to be quite expensive to rent the studio, et cetera. And I asked her if she knew other people who'd be interested. And in the end, there were 11 models. I booked 3 hours. I had 9 rolls of film and I was just shooting constantly. I had no time to think. So in a sense, actually, it was really nice because I was exhausted by the end, but I tried a ton of different things without really realizing I was changing the parameters. And it was only afterwards that I was looking back at the pictures and saying, okay, this is what I had done on this one. And I really like the look of this. So in a sense, I'd created my own chaos, but out of it came out like some archetypal successes that I've then tried to reproduce, if that makes sense.
Yeah. God, it's tiring stuff.
Yeah, but it's accelerating as well.
Oh God, yeah. I think this is one of the biggest things is finding that creative space, getting into the mood to do it, and then look, you know, times later, looking at the amazing results. It's not totally there straight away, is it? So
yeah, no, you're totally right. And yeah, and actually, you know, this looking back thing I think is really important to the photographic process in general, not just with this particular project, but I think quite often, and this is one of the things I like about film, and probably one of the reasons I'm doing more and more film in relation to digital, is that I think when you look at something immediately after having shot it, your vision is completely tainted by the moment that you shoot it and what you feel at that moment. And
so I think we're through the formal part, Ben, and I'd like to take you into my random questions.
Okay, let's go.
Okay. So I will start off with an easy one. So how about this? When was the last lie you told, and when did you last compliment someone?
Ha! And these can be the same moment.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I mean, you know,
when you can tell you're married.
When you have young kids, you kind of lie to them on a very regular basis because always telling the truth is actually going to hurt more, both educationally and emotionally. Yeah. So I can't give you an exact circumstance, but I would probably say it was today. You know, when did I last compliment somebody? Let me think. Well, actually, and you know, you might feel this is a bit of a cop out, but one of the things that I do very regularly, I don't know if you've seen, is a few days a week, I'll start my day by going through a certain hashtag on Instagram and looking for pictures that I really like. Okay. And then I share those pictures with some compliments on Instagram.
That's good.
And so the idea is both that, you know, any good pictures deserves to be seen a little bit more. And if I can, I mean, it's not like I have a massive following on Instagram anyway, but if I can just you know, get a few more people to see it, it's nice. But sometimes it sparks really cool conversations as well, because then people, I think when you realize that someone you don't know actually appreciates your work, it creates a bond that not everybody follows through with, but it sparks some really interesting conversations. So yeah, that's something I've been in the habit of doing. I know it's not a very personal answer I'm giving you, but I can't really think of a particular moment otherwise. I'm not someone who's stingy on compliments generally. So yeah, again, probably sometime this week anyway. But
no, I like that. That's really nice. And I suppose that's what I'm doing quite regularly, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely.
Following other people and then mentioning them and that. So
yeah, yeah. That's a good, it's great. It's great what you're doing. And I'm not just saying that, so that's one more compliment.
No, thank you, Ben. I appreciate that. Your next one then. So Hollywood are making the autobiography of your life. Who's going to play you?
Well, it's probably unrealistic time-wise, but I don't know, Patton Oswalt. I mean, he'd have to pack on a few more pounds to be realistic, but I think he'd make a good candidate. I don't know what he looks like with a beard, but you know, I think he'd make a good candidate. And he's funny and witty, and I think his heart's in the right place. So yeah, I'll go with him.
Okay, I like that. That's cool. What is the best thing in a children's playground?
It's got to be the merry-go-rounds, the kind of manual merry-go-rounds.
God.
If only because you can do some really cool long exposures with those. No, but also as a kid, I love them because they make you dizzy and you're constantly feeling like the centrifugal force is going to push you out. It's a really cool sensation. I haven't done it as an adult, but I'd probably break it if I sat on it, but I love them.
I go on them quite regularly, and I get dizzy within seconds now, so I've got to be careful. It's good fun. Having young kids, it's always good. If you could learn an animal language, which animal would you choose to communicate with?
Well, I could say the pangolin just to know if he's actually guilty of all this crap that we're putting on their head. But I don't know. Maybe rats. You know, they got to know everything because they're everywhere and they literally live with us even though we don't see them. So, yeah, I think talking rat would be fairly useful.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I like that. That's cool. Okay, so you get to either punch, have a pint, or give a present to each of the following. So you've got Ben Parker, as in Spider-Man's uncle, Benjamin Button, the guy who ages in reverse, or Ben Solo from Star Wars. So you got punch, present, or pint.
Okay, I'll have a pint with Button. Again, you know, that interesting an experience. I want to have a chat with that guy, and no better to do that than to have a pint.
Yeah.
I'll probably punch Ben Solo just because I'm not, this is horrible to say, but I, as a role player myself, I enjoy the world building in Star Wars, but I really don't enjoy the movies. I find them very kind of trite. So, you know, let's take it out on him. Yeah. which leaves me a present for Spider-Man's uncle. Yeah, sure. Why not?
Yeah.
don't know much about him, but I'm sure he deserves it.
Yeah. Well, I think so. Yeah, bringing up a young man that must have been pretty chaotic in his life.
Exactly. Plus, he's dead at the beginning, isn't he?
Yeah, he dies quite early, doesn't he? Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, let's give him a bit of joy before he goes.
You're too kind.
If we can, we should.
No, Lila. Well, thank you so much for going through those with me.
Yeah, that was fun.
What we always like to do is give people opportunity to find out where we can check out your work, Ben. So, where's the best places?
Well, I think, you know, lately I have really focused on kind of, I do have like a Facebook page and I have a website, et cetera, but I see that these don't get much traction anyway. So I don't see the point in giving people three or four different options and, you know, that dilutes everything. So I think the key thing is Instagram at Ben Felten, F-E-L-T-E-N. And, you know, that's where I basically post daily pictures on my, yeah, on weekdays. Every day there'll be a new picture. And then quite a few stories as well. I don't know if you saw the video. I actually posted a video of me printing a cyanotype this weekend. And so that was quite fun. So yeah, at Ben Felten, that's really the best place to see my work. Yeah, I don't want to dilute that. So let's focus on this one.
No, that's cool. And obviously you recently put together that lovely book that I got hold of. Have you got any of them left still then?
Yes, I do. The initial sales were quite nice. Now it's trickled down. I'm trying to get some people to review it so that it gets a bit more traction, but I still have some left. So basically, this is a collection of film shots from Shanghai that I took with the X-Band camera I was talking about earlier, with the panoramic mode. So these are panoramic views of the streets and sceneries of Shanghai, where I lived for 2 years. I wanted to give people an opportunity to feel like they were traveling there to a certain extent. I mean, that's I don't want that to sound a bit too pretentious, but, you know, kind of a brief moment of seeing something different. So there's a little bit of context on each picture, some anecdotes or some, you know, little pieces of information on life in Shanghai. It's a zine, so obviously the production quality isn't that of a book, but I think I've managed to do something that's relatively good looking, good quality reproduction from the printers. I have an Etsy store where that can be found, and the address is on my Instagram profile. I have a few prints there on sale as well. That's something I should work on and get more prints available there, but I haven't got my act together on this one. And actually thanks for buying it, because you were one of the first purchasers of it. And despite the postal chaos that we're going through, I think you received it. So that was a relief.
Yeah, it was really fast. It was unbelievable, that.
Yeah, it was great. So the idea is that I'm probably going to do some more of those. I'm trying to put together one on Hong Kong, but paradoxically, it's a lot harder in Hong Kong than it is in Shanghai, because the streets here are really narrow, and when you've got that wider field of view as you have on the X-Band, it's actually a kind of compositionally a big challenge to do narrow streets. So I'm working on getting more panoramic shots from Hong Kong so that I have more to choose from when I build the next one, probably in a few months' time.
It was lovely, because I liked the anecdotes inside, where you've told us a little bit about the people selling things like the fruit and veg, and that was really interesting. I couldn't believe that. It was really nice. And to me, that's an added element, so it's not just a photograph, because you're telling us a bit about the culture as well.
Yeah, that's the idea. That's the idea. It's as I said, I think if you had only the photographs, it'd be a visual journey with a little bit of text that I've added. I've tried to make it a cultural journey as well.
No, that's cool. So we'll put links to that anyway, Ben, don't worry. And then finally, I always ask my guests for a recommendation. For another photographer you might think could suit.
Right. So remember that I told you about this guy who does the kind of similar work than I do, but with Photoshop.
Yeah.
Well, that guy's got some film double exposure stuff that I find absolutely fascinating. And probably down the line is something I'm going to try and explore with all due respect for what he's doing. Basically, it's a series called, the guy's called Chris Rolander. He's a Finnish photographer.
Okay.
His series, I think it's called Jordan Displaced or something like that. And basically what he does is he takes a first shot of a jar that he's painted black inside. And then he takes a scenery. Usually it's nature, some trees, a landscape shot.
Hmm.
And the final result is that you really get a landscape in a jar.
Wow.
And it's absolutely fascinating. I encourage everybody to go, look at it, follow this guy. As I said, I much as I respect the artistry of what he does in Photoshop, it doesn't move me like his film stuff does. So at some point, I mean, I've been trying. I did one trial last spring. But it's technically quite challenging, I messed it up completely. So it's on the agenda. At some point, I'll revisit that and try and do a better job of it, with the idea of, on my side, of inserting like scenes of life in Hong Kong in the jar. If I had to recommend one guy only, that he's the guy that I would recommend.
Wow! Yeah. Can't wait for you to send me them details. Great. So all I can say is thank you.
Well, thank you. I know it's become a bit of a trite ending, but when I say keep up the good work, I mean it's really, truly important what you're doing. So keep doing it. Yeah, it's really amazing.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that. I suppose all I have to say then is au revoir, mon ami. So, thanks a lot, and we'll speak to you again soon.
Okay, cool. Thanks, Andrew.
There we go. Bye. Yeah, you take care, mate. Yeah, thank you for that. That was great.
All right.
Get everything in, yeah?
Cool, great. Yeah. I can go get dinner.
Same here, mate.
Probably waiting. It's going to be lunch.
No.
Right.
No, same here. No, well, you take care, mate. Love to family, and have a
excellent
good day.
So if you need anything from me, links, whatever, just ask him.
Yeah. Yeah, send me links to that guy as well. I've got your Etsy link.
Yeah.
Do you want to send me, say, 6 photos?
Okay.
And I'll get them on the website along with the podcast then, so they can listen and see.
Do you want a mix of the black and whites and the cyanotypes?
I think so. Yeah, I think that'll totally suit. Sure.
I'll do that. Okay, great.
And I'll try and get it done for this Wednesday as well.
Okay, wow. That's quick.
Yeah, that's cool. All right.
Just out of curiosity, do you have some stats on the listenership? Or?
Yeah, so we're up to about 100 a show.
Okay.
Is average, which is pretty amazing considering I didn't know anyone 2 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I had no friends whatsoever. There's this guy here. So that's 95 listens, right?
Yeah.
He's 23 years old,
uh-huh.
Something like this. He's only started like his lab last year.
Okay.
So he's totally inexperienced. And he's already had 95 listens. Yet Grant Britton, who's a legend in skate, I mean, he's been shooting 40 years.
Yeah.
He's had 105 listens.
Okay.
So this is what I say to people is, it doesn't matter how famous you are.
Yeah.
It's basically what people want and hear. It will go up over time. So like the first few people, they're like 180 listens.
Right. Okay. That's great. But I suppose part of it depends on me as well and spreading the word, right? So
it totally depends. Yeah. What I do is, I think, irrelevant most of the time. I think most people come back because what I do is when I post it Wednesday night, obviously it'll go out automatically to iTunes, Spotify, all these. I won't know what time it hits them. And then in the morning, I check the stats and you've already had 30 or 40 listens overnight.
Right.
And that's with no social media.
Yeah, I was going to say, because, I mean, I didn't know if you had other channels, but I was actually surprised that, you know, comparatively so few people followed you on Instagram. I would have imagined that because of the podcast, a lot more people would be following you.
Yeah.
So we got to get that word out as well.
Yeah, it's always surprising. You know, some of the legends that I've managed to get on, it doesn't do anything for you. Nothing. All it gets is you respect of someone else, which is more important.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And some of these people have been amazing and that you can keep going back to. I mean, Grant, we've been swapping photographers, which is really cool.
Yeah.
You know, he's a big name. Whereas some people won't even entertain an email ever again.
Yeah, well, you know. All right. Well, this is really cool. Thank you very much for taking the time to do this.
That's all right, mate.
And yeah, speak to you soon. Let me know when it's ready, and I'll make as much noise as my own limited channels can happen.
No, I appreciate that. Because hopefully I'll learn off you and get back into double exposure. I'm thinking about doing it.
Well, I mean, don't hesitate to, you know, discuss. I'm one of the things that I decided early on is that even though some of the stuff that I'm doing is not, you know, kind of common practice, is that I'm not about, you know, oh no, I don't want to tell anyone how I'm doing it. That's bullshit. I want to see some cool work from people who are trying the same techniques but applying it to something else. So,
yeah, I'm going to do so. I'm going to get a zine out at some point of my weird architecture shots I've been doing. And I've not told anyone at all how I do them because it's too easy. But as soon as I do it, that's going to be my whole point is you can do this, anyone can.
Okay, cool.
Basically, I just use an app. I put no effort in. It's just a few buttons, bang, done. Right, that's what I like. Because I'm not a very good editor.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing that.
Yeah. Cool, mate.
All right. Awesome.
You take care.
Have a good end of your Sunday, and speak to you soon.
Thanks, Ben.
Bye.
Bye.